Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Was Brexit inevitable? Was Theresa May a victim of poor decisions or impossible problems? And what is Boris Johnson's strategy and will it work? These are among the topics addressed in this episode of the Irish Economics Podcast. Hello and welcome to episode 2 of the Irish Economics Podcast. On today's episode, I am joined by Professor Edgar Morganroth, full professor of economics at DCU Business School. Today we're going to talk about Brexit, focusing on the strategy behind the decision making. So the main question here is, can we understand why past decisions were made? But also, can we give insight into what is motivating current decisions and use this insight to identify the likely outcome of negotiations over the coming months? So with that in mind, I suppose the place to begin is with the 2016 Brexit referendum. And it was widely believed that the Brexit vote was an attempt by David Cameron to put an end to a rising anti-EU sentiment within the Conservative Party. So Edgar, I suppose the first question here is, was there a better way to handle this sentiment?
Well, that's a very interesting question. Firstly, maybe one could go back a little bit further. Ultimately, there have been several decades of Euroscepticism in the UK, and there's been very little of proper information that sort of tries to counter that Euroscepticism. And at the time when David Cameron made this sort of promise that there would be a referendum if he was re-elected with a majority, he was fearful not just of some of the people within his own party who were pushing the Brexit agenda, but also UKIP. And I think he at the time thought that UKIP would take some seats from the Conservative Party if he didn't make that promise. Sure. Of course, at that point, it didn't look very likely that he would win this election anyway. Yeah. And so it was a bit of a surprise when he did come in with a majority. That then meant he would either have to renege on his promise or actually go through with it. And he decided to go through with it. An alternative to the referendum would have been to counter the Brexiteer arguments with facts. Yes. And very few people attempted to do that. That includes the academic community, and of which I am one. Economists were fairly silent on all sorts of Eurosceptic propaganda that you could read in some of the papers. So that would have been the alternative to holding the referendum, simply to actually counter the argument.
Maybe could it be said that Cameron may have panicked a little? I suppose one theory I have is that the first-past-the-post system might have distorted incentives.
The first-past-the-post system should normally make finding a majority more easy. If you think of the Irish system, which is a very much a proportional system, there have been coalitions for very many, many decades. And it's really not expected to find an absolute majority for one party. In the UK, that's possible. But what has happened is that opinions have polarized and parties have polarized and new parties have also emerged, like UKIP or now the Brexit Party, that if every one of those parties just gets a few seats, the arithmetic becomes very, very difficult, even in a first-past-the-post system. And I think that's where we are now. And, of course, the biggest issue for the Conservative Party is that it's internally split. And on top of that, we have a Labour Party that is also internally split. So finding any kind of majority when the two largest parties can't even find any kind of agreed position is almost impossible.
And it would appear then that the focus has moved away from the target objective of serving the people and the sorted incentives towards serving the needs of the party.
Yes, and I think at this stage we're very much faced with a situation where the debate is very inward facing. It's largely how does each group get what they want within Britain for many, and that includes Theresa May when she was Prime Minister. It seemed that the party was more important than the country, and the country was more important than getting a deal. And in that sense, you know, maybe the negotiations were doomed to failure anyway because the UK is so divided.
So you mentioned Theresa May. So there's two frames of thought, I suppose, when it comes to Theresa May and her tenure. Many people say that she made a lot of strategic errors, but she's also faced with a situation where there's this problem to solve, but there's so many different constraints that it's very hard to find a solution that would give you the outcome that they wanted.
I think her approach was extremely flawed. So before triggering Article 50, it would have been useful to actually trash out an agreed position that the House of Commons could support.
Yeah.
And failing to do that, she was negotiating on her own without the support of the Parliament. We know where that ended up. We've had so many votes on the withdrawal agreement and everything around it. Yeah. And, you know, the Parliament wants their cake. They want to eat it as well, and they want another one or two in spare. So it's impossible to negotiate when you're not sure. And indeed, even a year ago, I questioned, certainly on Twitter, whether it was worth negotiating with her at all, because it didn't look likely that any deal that she could come back with would find the support of the Parliament. Yeah. So that was the first problem that I think she made a mistake on. She should have gotten an agreed position and only then triggered the Article 50 negotiations. The second very big mistake she made is to start negotiating with the EU in a very confrontative way, rather than saying, look, you know, we have a democratic outcome here from a referendum. We're going to try and do this as amicably as possible. Instead, we had talk of war cabinets and things like that. And we're not paying any, the Brexit bill, that we don't have any liability, you can't force us and so on. So it was always a confrontation. So that meant that the EU was going to approach this in a very structured, very planned and quite rigid way. Yeah. Whereas if there had been goodwill from the UK from the start, there might have been ways of smoothing over some of the hurdles. Sure. Because there would have been trust. But when you go in and basically deny everything, argue over every little thing, the trust goes very quickly, and you can't then say, well, OK, we'll sort it out later or whatever. You then have to go and sort everything out up front and put it in writing. Mm-hmm. And so that was another mistake that she made. And I think she probably wasn't wise in the way she chose her various cabinet ministers. And there have been so many ministers coming and going. Actually, I lose track of who is actually in power now, who's in the different ministries. That hasn't helped for sure.
You want to find a grey area that you need to, in order to find a compromise, that you need a grey area, and that sort of dealing in absolutes just really is not a good strategy.
That may be another issue with her that I don't think she quite understood, and I think many UK ministers didn't and still don't understand that this isn't really diplomacy. This ultimately is something that has to be legally binding and precise. So you can't fudge things. So if the UK wants to do trade deals with third countries and they involve maybe letting chlorinated chicken into the UK, then we have, as the EU, have to have certainty as to whether we let that stuff into the EU or not. Sure. And chlorinated chicken is not allowed to circulate in the EU. So you immediately have an issue. So it's very, very precise and not open to grey areas and fudging. Sure. Of course, diplomats like fudging and they like getting a deal. But this has to be precise. And I think that was misunderstood in on the British side. And actually, I think on the EU side by some politicians in various countries as well, who thought that there would be some way of doing this. That is the reason why trade negotiations always take very long, because they're very precise. And CETA, for example, the Canada-Europe trade agreement, something like 7 years, it's a text of 1,100 pages, very, very precise, with lots and lots of exemptions that were all negotiated one by one and that are precise and legally binding.
And of course, then the whole Northern Ireland situation adds another layer of complexity onto that, where we have an agreement that works because of a lack of precision, I suppose.
And of course, the Good Friday Agreement wasn't a trade agreement. Sure. It would have looked very different if it was. Yeah. And so allowed that type of agreement allows for these grey areas. And now we're going to put a new agreement in place that interacts with this, and it's going to change things potentially. And that's the purpose of the backstop, is to avoid any changes that are material to the border, which would undermine the Good Friday Agreement.
Okay, so perhaps we can move on to discussing the current state of play and the decision-making facing Boris Johnson. So in order to understand Boris's decision-making, I suppose the first thing is to understand, well, what motivates his decision-making. And I can see three potential drivers behind Boris's decisions. First of all, doing what's best for the UK. Secondly, doing what's best for the Conservatives. Thirdly, doing what's best for Boris. So I wonder on which side of these decisions he lies. In my mind, it would be leaning towards Boris.
Well, I think in terms of priorities, I'm fairly sure that Boris puts himself first, the party second, and the country third. I think that's the case with many politicians. I think at the moment it is an extremely difficult to read situation because of what has happened over the last few days, and it's a very fluid situation. So, you know, in a day's time, the situation may already have changed a little bit.
Absolutely.
But what appears to be happening is that Boris is trying to avoid their legislation being passed by the parliament that would stop a no-deal Brexit. There is a majority, and we knew this back in March and indeed in February, there is a majority in the House of Commons to leave with a deal. So the majority does not want to leave without a deal. And of course, Boris has continuously said that if needs be, they will leave without a deal. And that is the threat that he is trying to push the EU with. And if the parliament took the threat off the table, then he would be left with pretty much nothing. So that is one interpretation of what's going on.
So basically, it's a move to strengthen his position with EU negotiations, and that if it's deal versus no deal, we need to make a better deal.
That is one interpretation. Now, I'm not sure that the EU is going to be pushed by any of this, and I think I'm pretty sure they're not. I think he's bluffing anyway, and he wants to keep his bluff up, and the bluff would be gone if the parliament decided that there would be a deal. Now, the parliament can decide all kinds of things. That doesn't mean it's going to happen, because of course the European side has to agree with whatever is going to come along, and the European side could easily say 31st of October, no extension, that's it. Out. And in fact, I have been in favour of and tried try to make a little bit of noise around this back in February, that given that the majority in the House of Commons want to leave with a deal, there is a deal there, if you put enough pressure on them that they have to choose between this deal and no deal, they will vote for this deal. But by agreeing for the extension, they didn't have to make that choice. And that is what I worry. And we could have a kind of a never-ending nightmare with this process if we keep on extending in the hope that somehow or another they're going to sort themselves out, which I'm not sure is going to happen. There is another possible strategy that Boris Johnson is pursuing, and that is to force a confidence vote and get an election that way. And that's what some people are arguing. Again, I don't quite follow this, because the chances of him returning with an absolute majority, I think, are smaller than they were before, because the Brexit Party is likely to take some seats. The Lib Dems will take some seats. What happens to Labour isn't exactly clear. There is a possibility that whatever gains the Conservatives have made in Scotland in the last election, they would lose again. And even in Northern Ireland, the DUP might be down a seat or two as well. So the chances of a majority for Boris, I think, actually smaller with an election. So I'm not sure that I follow that strategy either. I think he's in a very difficult position. He backed himself into a corner by saying 31st of October is it, with or without a deal. And we're not willing to put anything forward that is going to get us to a deal. So he's essentially not negotiating on the one hand, and he has nothing to negotiate with. Yeah. On the other hand, he is saying, well, we want a deal. He's kind of left out. You know, I don't think he has any cards left.
I suppose it's a game of poker, in that he has to pretend he has all the cards, but he knows deep down that the House of Commons will not accept no deal. So he can afford to be bullish without having to incur the costs that usually come with that.
But you end up running out of time, and that's what he's trying to do. He's running down the clock. I've always had this fear that that is exactly what the UK would do. They would run down the clock. The border issue is not solvable. If the UK insists on their red lines, it's not solvable. That there is no solution. So in that scenario, the strategy is to run down the clock and hope that somehow or another the EU line splinters, and that Ireland is basically sacrificed. And I don't think that's going to happen, because the EU at this stage has invested a lot in this and in holding the Irish position. And it's also something that other EU member states, smaller member states, will be watching. You know, if a small member state is threatened significantly by some decision that is taken at the central level, and there is no regard for it, I think that sets a very bad precedent. And again, I think in Brussels, one is keenly aware that they don't want to set that kind of precedent. So the EU position is unlikely to change.
Yeah.
So you know.
So he's running down the time basically to so the EU will act first and maybe sacrifice Ireland. That's the end game in that regard.
Okay. It is not a solvable problem. You can't have both. Leaving the customs union and the single market, and then have an open border. It is not possible.
The members of the opposition, Jeremy Corbyn, Lib Dems, etc., they all have a focus now on stopping a no-deal Brexit. That's where all their energy is going in. They're putting together some sort of a rebel alliance, as they're calling it, to try and stop this no-deal Brexit from happening. But that means they're putting no effort into planning for a general election. And there's a lot of talk about a potential general election, and that Boris is motivated by winning a general election. So I just wonder how this fits into the whole narrative.
That would imply that the Tories are preparing for an election, and I'm not sure that they're doing that either, because they seem to be internally so divided that you know, I think they're equally absorbed with the Brexit issue. So I'm not sure that the Tories are having any advantage in this. I think that all parties are very much absorbed with Brexit and not really preparing for an election. If there is an election, it will be all about Brexit anyway. Yeah. So maybe sticking with the Brexit topic is a relatively low risk strategy for all the parties anyway.
So one other thought on that is that with his hardline strategy, he seems to be consolidating the hardline Brexiteers behind him, which could help him when it comes to an election or whatever, or in terms of the Brexit strategy, whereas he seems to be fragmenting the anti-Brexiteers.
But it seems that the numbers of hardline Brexiteers don't make up a majority. And this is the problem. There is no majority for anything. And with something like that, I would have thought going back to the people with a referendum would have been the way out.
Yeah.
But that seems to be the bit that almost everyone has been dismissing, and certainly on the Tory side. That might have been the simplest way to get out of this bind, because ultimately the present situation is going to damage democracy within the UK, and by doing what he's doing currently, suspending Parliament, this is the sort of stuff that you would have seen in sort of fascist regimes. You know, that is an amazing development to think that Parliament is essentially shut down to facilitate something or to prevent something democratic from happening, because if there's a majority in the House of Parliament, it is democratic.
So perhaps next we can turn to Jeremy Corbyn. Jeremy is an interesting character in that he's anti-EU, if you believe some of the signals he's given in the past, and would probably like to see Brexit passed. I wonder, he is in a difficult position, but what would be his best strategy going forward?
Yeah, I always thought that his optimal outcome would be a Brexit delivered by the Tories that goes in some way wrong and delivers an election that he would win.
Yes.
I'm not sure that quite such a scenario is on offer. And that's why he is now considering different options. But ultimately, he wants to become prime minister. That seems to be what he is trying to do. And that then makes it less likely that you could form a cross-party or cross-interest government in the House of Commons, because there would be some Tories that are Remainers who would be suspicious of him, some kind of a power grab. I think that would be the same with some Lib Dems. They would worry about it. And of course, even the likes of the SNP or the Welsh, who have been competing traditionally with Labour, would be electorally very suspicious of Corbyn. So it is kind of a perfect storm in terms of the sort of makeup of the Parliament in Westminster and the leaders that are present at the moment. It makes the worst possible outcome so much more likely, unfortunately. Yeah. If you had someone like Tony Blair there, it would have been a hell of a lot easier for some of the Conservatives to say, OK, well, we'll go with this guy, because he wasn't quite so far from them anyway.
Yeah, sure.
But Corbyn, of course, is quite a distance from the sort of even more moderate Tories. So I think that would be quite difficult for them to swallow that one.
Yeah, absolutely. There was that proposal, of course, where it would be a cross-party effort to try and stop no-deal Brexit, which would not have Jeremy Corbyn as head, but have somebody who'd be more palatable on Labour and Conservative sides. But I wonder, is that something that he would go for?
Well, he is the leader of the Labour Party. So for him to be sort of sidelined like that, I think his pride wouldn't swallow that one. And, yeah. and I think he wouldn't go with it. So coming up with alternative names like Ken Clark, I don't think he would go for it. It's his way or no way. And that seems to have been very much what we've seen from Corbyn. And his way, unfortunately, does include a Brexit. And so I think his strategy, well, his optimal outcome is still that the Tories deliver Brexit.
Yeah, yeah. So.
And hopefully screw up in some way.
OK, so the final player then in the whole Brexit negotiation is the EU. And more recently, the EU have come out and have acknowledged that a no-deal Brexit is becoming increasingly more likely. And this seems like the perfect foil to Boris Johnson's approach. Boris Johnson is taking the hardline approach, saying, you know, it's no deal or a better deal, and which is trying to spook the EU. But if the EU are coming out and saying, well, you know what, a no deal is not necessarily, you know, we're getting ready for a no deal, well, it seems like this is the perfect way to undermine his argument.
A no deal is more damaging to the UK than to the EU.
Yes, exactly.
And by quite a margin. So this is why the bluff of a no deal, I think, isn't going to work. You know, if you say, well, I'm going to shoot myself in the leg and you might possibly get splattered with a little bit of blood. I don't think you're going to do it, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So that is the kind of bluff he's playing, and it just doesn't. I don't think it's going to make the EU change their approach.
Yeah.
Ultimately, they have played this very straight. I was surprised when Barnier went with the all UK backstop option. I think that was one step too far.
Yeah.
Other than that, pretty much everything that has come out of the negotiations was pretty much foreseeable. There was nothing unusual. The EU is the larger partner in the negotiations by, again, a long margin. The UK is the small one. And in these kind of negotiations, the large one usually gets the bulk of what they want.
Yeah.
And the EU has done this in trade negotiations previously. It's well known. They're not going to take a different approach. So they have done it pretty smartly, pretty predictably. I think there have been a few mistakes made, partly, I think, possibly by Ireland, actually, in that moving on to phase two of the negotiations was done on the back of the backstop that was part of the report that was published, I think, in November, December in 2017. And, of course, the backstop is a clever insurance policy. The problem with that report, though, is that it's not legally binding. And so we hear Simon Coveney, for example, now talking about the UK reneging on their commitments. But these commitments were never binding.
Mm.
And as such, there was always that chance that they would renege on them.
Right.
And the Irish government and the EU bought those commitments knowing that they could be backed out of.
Yeah.
So I think at the time it would have been better to try and craft something that would have been legally binding. And I think that would have moved the whole thing on a bit further.
Yeah.
As I said earlier, the UK always, to me, had that strategy to run the clock down, get an agreement at the very last minute, and Ireland and the Irish border issue would just be, that would be the sacrifice that the EU would make. That strategy could have been absolutely stopped at that point in time. We're not moving to phase two until you have something legally binding.
Yeah.
So that was, I think, possibly a mistake. And I think not pushing the House of Commons at the end of March to that choice, this agreement or out at that point, was another mistake. Again, I think we could have had an agreement at that time.
Yeah.
And I again, I highlighted it at the time, what would be the outcome of the extension? It was always more likely that May would be going and would be replaced by Boris Johnson. I think it was easier to do business with Theresa May.
Okay, so maybe we can sum up this section by maybe thinking about what these strategies are, maybe summarising them and trying to see what might be coming down the line. Okay, we start with Boris then. As we said, he wants a better deal and he's willing to leave with no deal in order to make this claim stronger. He's blocking the House of Commons to try and make this a stronger case. In order to get his better deal, he's relying on the EU and Ireland to cave in. And as we've discussed, it's going to be quite difficult for the EU and Ireland to cave in. It's quite unlikely that they'll cave in. So then, what's the likely outcome? Well, to avoid a no deal, I suppose one of two things needs to happen. Number one, Boris needs to back down, and this seems like a politically very difficult thing for him to do. Secondly, the rest of the Commons need to save the UK from no deal. But of course, this is becoming increasingly more difficult.
The only way I can see that we're going to get a deal is that if this deal is pushed through, without any kind of trying to make changes, there are no alternative arrangements that. And there cannot be any alternative arrangements that deal with the border issue. It's up to the UK to find such arrangements. But, we now call that chasing unicorns. Ultimately, these don't exist. Trusted trader scheme, what does that mean? Well, we already have that in place, actually. The issue around borders is not about the legal trade, the above board trade. It's about the illegal trade. And a trusted trader scheme or technology that does number plate recognition isn't capable of looking inside the trucks and see what's in them. And that is ultimately the problem. And even if we had that, the nature and the status of the border would have changed, which is politically important. It's politically important, particularly for the nationalist side in Northern Ireland. And the escalation of violence in Northern Ireland that we have seen over recent months, I think is directly attributable to this whole Brexit issue and the threat to the border. We don't see widespread support for this, but some of these more radical elements that some of us had thought or hoped had gone away, they're re-emerging on the back of this Brexit issue. And so even if you could find some kind of a technical solution, the fact would remain that politically the border has changed its status, and that's good enough for those people.
Yeah.
And so, from that perspective, it's absolutely correct for the EU and the Irish side to insist on the backstop to avoid this change of status. So I would push this all the way.
Yeah.
The UK side has had 3 years to come up with alternative arrangements that would actually work.
Yeah.
They don't exist and nobody will come up with them. We have lots of people coming out of the woodwork now at the last minute with some clever solution that turns out never to be a solution.
Yeah.
Because other people would have thought about it all along. So that is really the only way I think we're going to get to an agreed, orderly Brexit. And unfortunately, I think the chances have for a long time now been bigger that there is going to be a no deal Brexit.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, and this is something that I think on the EU side we have to realise, is that the Brexiteers won the referendum.
Yeah.
And Brexit to them didn't mean a situation like Norway. It meant out of the single market, out of the customs union. So
yeah,
they won. And it'll be very unusual for them to have won and not get what they wanted.
So basically, Boris Johnson's strategy is going to be really tough now.
There's actually a possibility that he does not care whether it's a deal or no deal.
Yeah.
I mean, we can't look into his head, but he has been so swathing about the EU for so long. I mean, he's wrote some of the crazy stories about the EU that sort of fed the Eurosceptic base. There's a possibility he believes that stuff. There's a possibility that he really believes that the UK must leave, and maybe without a deal is the best way to leave. I think he's very wrong, because ultimately he wants a deal, a trade deal at some point with the EU, and leaving on bad terms is just about the worst way to get a basis for negotiations in the future. And again, that brings me back to what I said earlier about Theresa May and her confrontational approach. That is the worst way to get your way in the end.
Yeah. So that's interesting. You mentioned the fact that he doesn't want to leave on bad terms, and he's going about that the wrong way at the moment. But then there's also the fact that we have no infrastructure. You touched on that already. Well, minimal if when it comes to a no-deal situation in Ireland and in the UK. But does that make it a no-deal situation an impossibility, in that if we knew now for certain that there's going to be no deal Brexit, we wouldn't have the infrastructure to do it. It would likely to be postponed until we do have the infrastructure.
The unfortunate thing is that there's also the sort of blame game that has to be played out, and that is where the EU and the Irish side don't want to be blamed for any border infrastructure by putting it up before it actually is necessary.
Okay.
And that then creates a vacuum, I think, and I think it's a mistake to go down that route. It doesn't really matter who the English or British people blame at the end. It doesn't really matter. Yeah. As long as the EU and the Irish side know who to blame, that is all that matters to us. Yeah. But they are worrying about who is going to put the blame on the mess in Britain. I wouldn't worry about that. They're going to be no longer a member of the EU and therefore a third country and not that relevant.
Well, so you mentioned before about the Brexiteers. They wanted a certain type of Brexit, but at the time of the referendum, it wasn't really clear what Brexit meant. So you have the sort of circular system where you have, as you were saying, you don't have a majority for anything, but you don't have a majority for Remain, you don't have a majority for hard Brexit, you don't have a majority for soft Brexit.
Yeah, I mean, the one of the things about Brexit that I think most of us, me included, didn't realise is the complexity. The EU and the relationships that we have with the other EU countries are so intense and so diverse, actually disentangling oneself from that is very difficult. Yeah. And you come into the most peculiar areas of legislation where there are issues. And I think that wasn't understood at all. And I think within the English establishment, Northern Ireland and the Irish border wasn't really perceived as an issue at the time of the Brexit referendum. There were plenty of people who tried to bring that to the debate. I know I spoke in Northern Ireland and also in London before the referendum, tried to make the point that this is going to be an issue, but nobody was really that interested in Northern Ireland. And I think there were a lot of things or a lot of dimensions to Brexit that were not understood or ignored, that if they had been understood by the public and if the public hadn't been misled by some of the propaganda that we saw at the time in terms of the cost of the EU and so on, they might have chosen a different path. Again, if you felt that that was a problem, then you could have held or could hold another referendum. Yeah. But of course, the Brexiteers won the day. They don't want to hold another referendum that overturns this result.
Sure.
They want this result.
Okay, so just in terms of the final section, maybe we'll just think about the potential impacts. I know you've done some research on in terms of household impacts. Maybe you could just give us an idea of some of the figures in that regard.
Yeah. So we've looked a little bit. I mean, this is one of the things that often puzzles me. most countries, Ireland included, seem to worry about Brexit in terms of exports. The UK is a large market. We export a lot to them. So that's where the problem is. But of course, we also import a lot from the UK. And Ireland is unique in that sense that when it comes to goods, we're very significantly dependent on goods coming from the UK. So if we had a hard Brexit, we would have a tariff regime because the UK would become a third country. And we already know the tariffs that the EU has registered with the WTO. So in the research that I've done with a colleague at the Economic and Social Research Institute, Martina Lawless, we've looked at the impact of the imposition of these tariffs on prices. And it's quite interesting. So the average family or household would end up spending somewhere between 900 and 1400 euros more because of the imposition of the tariffs. Now, of course, that's a static analysis. If we bought the same goods from other EU partners, then those tariffs wouldn't apply, but presumably higher transport costs would. So prices would definitely go up. Our estimates say somewhere between 2 and 3.1% with substitution to other goods from other EU countries. That would be a bit smaller, but it would definitely be noticeable.
Sure, yeah, absolutely. So so this is at the household level in terms of your basket of goods and services.
And what's interesting here is the types of goods that we receive from the UK are the types of goods that are perhaps a bit more important in the basket of the poorer households. And of course, poorer households more generally spend more money on goods versus services. And so there's a distributional implication for households that the poorer households get hit much worse proportionally than the richer households. And then we've done other analysis looking at the export side. And here we find that particularly the agri-food sector is vulnerable, but there are a few other sectors. For example, the wood and wood products, over 80% of their exports go to the UK. And that's also where the tariffs are highest. If the UK reciprocated with a similar tariff, then those sectors would be hit very badly. And of course, those sectors are regionally distributed or most frequently found in the poorer regions. So, for example, in County Monaghan, one in five jobs is in agri-food. So if that sector gets hit because of tariffs, then you would expect that county will suffer the worst.
That would be the immediate overnight effect if the border went up in the morning. I imagine as time goes on, they might dissipate might be an adjustment.
And there are two different things happening. So initially you would have contracts in place, so you typically still want to fulfill your contracts, and that binds you into certain things. So if you're an exporter and you've contracted to be paid in sterling, for example, you take the exchange rate risk. That could be negative. But eventually these contracts are finished and then there'll be new contracts. And so those particular issues are resolved. On the other hand, you know, you have established trading relationships with producers or wholesalers in the UK, and switching from those is not that easy. And likewise, if you're producing, say, a food product that is for the UK market, tastes are not the same everywhere in the EU. So selling this one product somewhere else is not necessarily easy. You're going to have to win shelf space in supermarkets, for example, which you can't easily do. So switching is difficult. So that would suggest that the impact would be biggest fairly early on, and then eventually, you know, over time would reduce as you find new trading partners, new markets, you sort out some of the logistics chain issues that also going to face us. So over time, you would expect that impact to lessen.
Okay, so I think that seems to be it. Edgar, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.